Yo.
And why are there Bernie bros and not Bernie hoes?
So there are.
Did we talk about having edibles at my holiday party?
And that I always underestimated is that men really like breasts.
Do you think I'm a Karen?
Valentine's Day is like New Year's Eve with nuclear weapons.
What you just said was so slut-shaming. And I wanted to
see how it's slut-shaming. Welcome to the Femsplainers. I'm Danielle Crittenden. So this episode is going to be on a theme of Annie, get your gun. Or maybe actually more like, Annie, stop. Don't get your gun. Just going to hurt someone. I'm inspired to tackle gun issues as they relate to women by some recent events, which I'll get to, and also by a new book by NPR's Washington investigative correspondent called Misfire: Inside the Downfall of the NRA by Tim Mack. Now, before our card-carrying NRA listeners, if we have any, get annoyed and start waving your firearms about in defense of your Second Amendment rights, calm down. This is exactly the problem whenever gun rights and gun control is discussed. As with so many issues today, it's become an either-or situation. Either we all accept the status quo of mass shootings and tragic avoidable accidents, like as happened with Alec Baldwin, or, as the argument goes, liberals want to come and confiscate everyone's guns and right to self-protection. And the result is a stalemate in the debate in which those of us, the majority, for what it's worth, would like to see some reasonable measures taken that would at least thwart, if not eliminate, a lot of the gun violence that disproportionately plagues the United States compared to virtually every other Western country. And it's an issue that especially affects women and children, one that is rapidly escalating. So here are some quick facts. Americans bought more than 23 million firearms in 2020, which was up 65% from 2019. And that surge is only continuing. More people were shot dead in 2020 than at any time since the 1990s. And 2021 is shaping up to be even worse. And very soon, the Supreme Court will hear a case that it could expand gun rights even further. Gun advocates will note that despite the publicity, mass shootings are not how most gun owners use guns. And they're right. It's also the problem. The majority of Americans buy semi-automatic handguns, the kind you store in a night table or a glove compartment, which they say they bought to protect themselves and their families. And this is how most gun violence ends up occurring. The guns are left loaded and unsecured, and then they're picked up by a child or a teenager contemplating suicide or used to needlessly escalate a common dispute. And that especially means domestic disputes. Recent studies show that some 4.5 million American women have been threatened by a gun-wielding partner or former partner, and almost 1 million American women have survived after a gun was used by a partner against them. So again, I want to stress, this episode is not about the right to own a gun. It's about the impact they are having on our culture and how we might begin to positively change that culture. So joining me up top for the cocktail segment, or I think in this case, we should call it the Molotov cocktail segment, is Shannon Watts, who is the founder of Moms Demand and the author of Fight Like a Mother. Shannon has been on the program in the past, and I don't think she'd take offense if I described her as something of a pistol. When the Sandy Hook kindergarten shootings happened in December 2012, Shannon was a 41-year-old former communications executive who put her career on hold to become a full-time stay-at-home mom of five. But as she writes, the day after the Sandy Hook tragedy, she started a Facebook group with a message that all Americans can and should do more to reduce gun violence. The online conversation turned into a grassroots movement of Americans fighting for public safety measures to protect people from gun violence across the country. And since then, Moms Demand Action has established a chapter in every state and is part of Every Town for Gun Safety, the largest gun violence prevention organization in the country, has over 6 million members. And today, Shannon is not only one of the most prominent voices for gun reform in America, she's also an active board member of Emerge America, one of the nation's leading organizations for recruiting and training women to run for office. And as you'll hear, her philosophy is similar to the mothers who founded Moms Against Drunk Drivers back in the 70s. So aside from lobbying for legislative changes, her group seeks to educate public opinion about the many dangers of just simply keeping unsecured guns at home. And after Shannon, I'll be joined, as mentioned, by Tim Mack. And his book is just incredible. Again, it's called Misfire, Inside the Downfall of the NRA, and is about how the National Rifle Association changed from a nonpartisan organization that essentially used to represent hunters and advocated for responsible gun ownership into a major inflamer of the culture wars. And along the way, Tim exposes how its leadership under Wayne LaPierre managed to take millions upon millions of hard-earned dollars from our NRA members and spend them lavishly on executive perks and salaries. The organization is now currently under multiple investigations. But one of the aspects of Tim's book that interested me most, especially from a femsplainer angle, was how the NRA began to cynically exploit the fears of women, and also how its largely middle-aged, cigar-chomping male leadership was in turn cynically exploited by a young, vivacious female Russian spy. Oh, yes. I should say that I've known Tim for a long time. My husband, David, and I gave him his first reporting job when we ran a conservative website out of the garage in our backyard during the aughts. Tim was our most dogged correspondent. He would chase down congressmen as they were getting into their cars or trap them in revolving doors for a quote. And I'm just so proud of the incredible reporting work he is producing today. And just as a reminder, before we first bring on Shannon Watts, if you are enjoying the podcast and are not yet a member or supporter at patreon.com/femsplainers, really urge you to go there. We depend on your support to keep this podcast going. You can join at whatever you can afford, and you get a friends with benefits arrangement. In return, you get a monthly bonus episode in which you get to ask our guests the questions. You get our monthly newsletter. We do a monthly cocktail gathering for our supporter community. And at certain levels, you'll get this podcast ad-free. So again, patreon.com/femsplainers. Let's bring on Shannon Watts. What I like about Bonafide products is there's one for every woman in our family. I like the Relizin, which gives me relief from hot flashes and night sweats. And for my daughters, there's Serenol, which gives them relief from emotional PMS symptoms, which, you know, I think we can all appreciate. They have many other products as well. As a woman, what I like most is that Bonafide products provide women real relief without compromise. So don't waste another minute feeling less than your best. Give Bonafide a try today. No prescription is required. Go to hellobonafide.com. That's hello, B-O-N-A-F-I-D-E. Go to hellobonafide.com and use code FEMSPLAIN to save 20%. That's hellobonafide.com and use code FEMSPLAIN to save 20%. Shannon, welcome back to the Femsplainers.
I'm so thrilled to be here.
Well, it's fantastic. I think we had you on a couple of years ago, probably, I'm guessing, in the last round of elections. And now we've just passed another group of elections. And how did you feel they went from your perspective as a gun control advocate?
Well, you know, it's a mixed bag. And certainly, having been through many electoral cycles now in the last almost a decade of being a volunteer with Moms Demand Action, you know, that's sort of the cyclical nature of politics. You know, we knew this election in Virginia was going to be an uphill battle. A Democrat has only won the governor's race there once when his party also held the White House in the last 50 years. But yeah, it was hard to watch the governorship being given over to a lifetime NRA member. We're going to live to fight another day there. We still hold the Senate. We are going to do everything in our power to prevent any rollback of the huge legislative progress we've made on gun safety in the last 2 years. We did hold our gun sense governor in New Jersey. He is, Phil Murphy's the first Democratic governor in 4 decades to win re-election in that state. So I know it was close, but ultimately we won. And then Moms Demand Action, 12 of our volunteers were elected across the country, including the new mayor of Cincinnati, which is America's 64th largest city. He is a Moms Demand Action volunteer. So, you know, I wish Virginia had gone a different way, but we will make sure they don't roll back our progress.
Your group now has more members than the NRA, but those of us standing on the sidelines just feel kind of helpless. It's like it's either or. Either we just accept these mass shootings, you know, like the weather, like a storm coming through, and they're just going to keep coming through. And there's seemingly nothing we can do about it. But I think you made the strategic decision to start fighting this at the state levels and with individual candidates. So maybe talk a little bit about how that strategy works, how it's succeeding, and what you mean by sort of common sense gun solutions. Like, you know, what does that mean?
Yeah. So, you know, I want to be clear, first of all, we're not anti-gun. We're not opposed to the Second Amendment. Many of our volunteers are gun owners or their partners are gun owners. For us, this is just about restoring the responsibilities that are supposed to go along with gun rights and do in other nations. That lack of responsibility, which has eroded and been eroded by the NRA over the last several decades, is why America has a 25 times higher gun homicide rate than any peer nation. And you know, going back to the results of election night, you know, Glenn Youngkin didn't win in Virginia because he was touting his NRA credentials. He won because he hid his position on gun safety from voters, right? We know that when candidates run on this issue, they win. And so I think one thing we learned is that we have to continue holding this up as an issue and forcing candidates to answer tough questions about where they stand, right? And our volunteers do that all over the country, every single electoral cycle. And so to your point, local politics is more important than ever. We are showing up at state houses and school boards, city councils, in boardrooms. And also, we know the best way to change this issue, and this is certainly a marathon, not a sprint, but is to run for office ourselves. That's how you get gun safety champions in office. And so we have launched Demand a Seat, which helps train our volunteers to move from not just shaping policy, but to actually making it. Now, all of this is because we are waiting for this cathartic moment in Congress that hasn't happened. It will, I promise you, this is inevitable. But in the meantime, it's important to remember that even though Congress is intractable on every issue, right? It isn't just guns. We have had some major victories there. So just this last week, the Biden-Harris administration announced a new program. They're going to promote secure gun storage. It's how we keep guns out of the hands of criminals and minors, people who are suicidal.
Toddlers.
And toddlers, yes, sadly. And then also the Build Back Better Act includes a truly historic amount of funding for community violence intervention programs, about $5 billion. So, you know, progress is rarely linear, but it is always being made.
And how do these, so what are some of these effective things, proposals and legislation that actually work?
Yeah.
So money for locking up your gun, which is this, you would think would be 101, but isn't. And every day there's some horrific story of someone finding a gun. So how would that work? And then what are some of the other solutions that you propose that you think are workable and really will lead to a decrease in these horrors that we see every day?
You know, what I think makes us so unique as an organization is that we are nonpartisan. We are willing to work with people on both sides of the aisle. And all of our solutions, all of the things we're working to change culturally, legislatively, they are driven by data to be effective. That's really important to us. The government hasn't been able to do a lot of research, but we have a whole team in-house who focuses on looking at different states, right? In many ways, America is a petri dish. There are states with strong gun laws and there are states with very weak gun laws. And when you look at the data, this is pretty intuitive, but what it shows you is states with stronger gun laws have less gun crime and fewer gun deaths. So what are those laws and what are those policies? First of all, a background check on every gun sale. When background checks were passed in this country in the 90s, there was not an online marketplace to buy and sell guns. And so there's this huge gaping loophole that does not require unlicensed dealers, and that could be someone at a garage sale or a gun show or someone you meet online. It doesn't require them to complete a background check when a gun is sold. Millions of guns are sold this way every single year. And, you know, you can liken it to if you were to go to the airport and you were a terrorist and you could get in a line to go through security or in a line where you don't have to go through security, which one would you get in? It's pretty obvious. Domestic abusers, criminals, minors, people are able to get guns easily in this country with no questions whatsoever. So that is fundamental to the entire gun safety system. On top of that, we know when we keep guns away from domestic abusers, we save many lives. There's a loophole in federal law that allows domestic abusers who are dating partners or stalkers to have easy access to guns. They're not considered prohibited purchasers. So we've been working to close that loophole through the Violence Against Women Act. I think that will happen. But in the meantime, we've gone state by state. 29 states have now passed laws that prevent all domestic abusers from having access to guns, and things like a red flag law, which allows families or police to petition a judge for a temporary restraining order that removes the guns from someone who is a danger to themselves or others. Again, completely intuitive and something you would think that the police were logically allowed to do, but you actually have to pass the laws and then educate people that those laws exist. So those are sort of our priorities around common sense gun legislation. In terms of secure gun storage, there are states that are passing these laws. Colorado is one of the most recent, but we also have a program called Be Smart, where we simply educate gun owners and non-gun owners and send materials home, for example, through school boards to encourage people to keep their guns locked, unloaded, and separate from ammunition.
Can you be liable if I don't put away my gun properly and then a kid or somebody takes it and is used in a crime? Do I face any liability currently for that?
Yes. You assume that you would, right?
Right. Exactly. Yes. I left my pool open and didn't have a proper fence around it and the kid drowned. I would be liable.
Exactly. I liken it to, you know, having grown up in the 80s, you know, someone would get in their car and kill their whole family because they chose to drink and drive. And then everyone would say, oh, what a horrible tragedy. We can't punish them. They've suffered enough. And then a group of moms came along and said, wait a minute. Laws are the moral underpinning of our society. If we don't hold people accountable, these senseless tragedies are going to keep happening. And within 10 years, they passed incredibly strict laws that hold people accountable when they make those decisions. Only about 28 states have laws that require adults to securely store their firearms. Most of those laws result in a misdemeanor, about a $400 fine, right? So it is really important that states hold people accountable for securely storing their firearms. But on top of that, most states don't require people to report when a gun has been lost or stolen. Where do most illegal guns come from? They were legal guns that were left in someone's car. So these are all laws that the NRA opposes over and over again and have prevented from passing. But, you know, our volunteers show up every gun bill hearing and work to change the law slowly but surely.
But you point out, you know, as a woman, you're not anti-gun. Women are usually, contra our intuition, we are not safer with guns. We are not safer with guns in the house. We are not safer with our partners having guns. You want to talk a little bit about the negative effects, the victims of gun law? It's not these spectacular shootings, bad as they are, but every day it's a woman or a child being hurt in a domestic dispute.
That's exactly right. Most mass shootings in this country are started by a domestic violence incident. We know that women who are in domestic situations where there's abuse and there's a gun, they're five times more likely to be shot and killed with that gun. And so, you know, it's incredibly dangerous for women. Not that the NRA cares. They do their best to hide that data. And you know, when you look at the gun sales since COVID started, tens of millions of guns, it's estimated, you know, somewhere around 40 million gun sales because the NRA exploited the crisis and the chaos to juice gun sales. Many of those gun sales were first-time gun buyers, many to women, something we're starting to see increase that we hadn't seen before. And we were talking about children. You know, these women may be buying guns because they think they're using them for protection. About 4.6 million children lived in homes with unsecured guns before COVID. We know that number is now somewhere around 5.4 million. Wow. And then you keep looking at that trajectory and you know that most school shooters are actually students. And where do they get their guns? They get them from home. And we are seeing more incidents of gunfire on school grounds this school year than since we started tracking it back in 2013. So those guns that women may be around or buying that they think are going to make them safer, precisely the opposite is true.
One of the, I saw in an interview, you said that, you know, we're having, speaking of culture wars, these wars over children wearing masks. But you said the active shooter drills in schools are associated with a 39% increase in depression, 42% increase percent in stress and anxiety, and a 23% increase in psychological health problems overall. So the very fact that we're having to do this, like I think of it as like the nuclear era duck and cover under your desk drills, is also in itself mentally destabilizing to kids across the country.
Absolutely. You know, imagine you're on an airplane and they do an unannounced drill and they pretend that the plane is going down. Would you ever fly again? I wouldn't. So we're sending our kids to school. We're doing these unannounced drills where they have to hide in the bathroom of their classroom as though the door, the bathroom door is going to protect them from a spray of an AR-15. And then we expect that to not have any impact on them. It's really important to remember that these drills, this is a business just like anything else. It's a multi-million dollar industry. There's absolutely no data that shows these drills are effective in an active shooter situation. There is data, as you mentioned, that shows they cause depression and sleeplessness and worsening school performance, and not just anxiety in children, but actually in teachers and parents too. So if you go to our website, you'll see that we give a lot of recommendations around drills. I'm the mom of five. My kids are grown now, but if I had to do it all over again, I would not let them go through active shooter drills. But if you do, it's important that they not simulate gun violence and that you're given a heads up before they occur.
So how can people find you, Shannon, join up, become a part of this movement if they feel like it, if they want to help? And you're saying it's not pointless, that there is real active progress that we can make.
Yes, we are making huge progress. I think it's like any social issue in this country. You have to build momentum on the ground that eventually points the right Congress, the right president, the right Supreme Court in the right direction. We've seen that over and over again. And we're not just moms anymore. We're mothers and others. We also have students demand action, too. So if you want to get involved, just text the word READY to 64433. You can also go to momsdemandaction.org and find more information on how to sign up there.
Okay. Well, thank you, Shannon, for all the work you do. And thank you for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
Good luck with everything.
Thank you.
Always inspired to hear from Shannon. And I always am given hope when I speak to her. And again, if you're interested in learning more about how Moms Demand Action, you can go to momsdemandaction.org and you can either contribute or get involved. And now let me bring on, after a word from one of our sponsors, Tim Mack. He is, again, the author of Misfire: Inside the Downfall of the NRA.
This is Walk-Ins Welcome with Bridget Bettisi.
I love hearing people's stories of resilience and grit. This is why I created this podcast.
We are very excited to welcome Jim Gaffigan, Yasmin Mohammed, Glenn Beck, Tim Dillon, Abigail Schreier, Jeff Garland, Ayan Hirsi Ali, Sam Harris, Heather Hying, Jonah Goldberg, Ben Shapiro, Glenn Greenwald, Sarah Shahi, Colin Quinn.
If there's a culture of victimhood, then let's tell stories of grit and survival.
Subscribe and listen now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Tim, welcome to the Femsplainers.
Thanks so much for having me.
What a thrill to have you. What you've done is absolutely huge. And I remember you, gosh, how many years ago when you first got involved in this story, telling us about this odd Russian woman that you'd gotten a tip about, and she seemed to be hanging around with Republicans, and it seemed very strange, and you were starting to look into it, but and then it all kind of unfurled from there.
Yeah, the way I started writing about the National Rifle Association was years ago in the 2016-2017 timeframe. A source sat down with me for breakfast and started talking about this woman, this Russian woman who had some weird attributes, would describe herself differently to different people depending on her audience. So to some, she would say that she was a gun rights activist. To others, she would say that she was a Russian government official. To still others, she would say she was a translator or a small business owner or just a graduate student in Washington, D.C.
And where was this source? Weird. Who was it? Not literally who was the source, but what world did they come from that they decided they needed to tell you about this?
Just a world in which they would bump into Maria Butina, who was in graduate school at the time at American University, who was showing up to all sorts of political events, and also really networking heavily and trying to infiltrate at the time the National Rifle Association. I found this incredibly weird, looked into it a little bit more, and found that she had led a delegation of senior NRA officials to Moscow in 2015. And you have to like kind of put yourself in that time. If you'll remember in the 2016-2017 time, there were all these stories breaking about Russian influence in the 2016 elections. And there was not a lot of understanding about exactly what shape that took. But one of the things that actually did happen was that this Russian government agent, Maria Butina, was trying to infiltrate the NRA and build networks at the time for the benefit of the Russian government.
Now, the thing about, let's describe her. One of the things I really enjoyed about your book were these little wonderful, vivid sketches of your characters or real people, but seemingly like characters. Wayne LaPierre, of course, being the most vivid there of the NRA. But Maria Butina was this 20-something, very young, redhead, vivacious, seemed to operate her sexuality as needed. It was sort of embarrassing to me how readily these executive men kind of fell all over themselves trying to talk with her and accommodate her. And as you say, I mean, you told me about it. I remember I said, what, she's Russian? What are people doing with her? Why are they hanging around with her? It seems obvious, especially a very attractive young woman finding men in their, late 40s, 50s, 60s, who are in charge of a National Rifle Organization, really attractive and scintillating. Like it seems like a honey trap, and yet everyone went along with it.
You know, some people went along with it and some people caught on to it right away. You know, Chris Cox, who was the top lobbyist at the NRA for many, many years, warned Donald Trump Jr. to stay away from Maria Butina. He had noticed that they had met, and he said, after the fact, you know, there's something weird about, a semi-attractive person hanging out with all these old guys. Like, what is the deal with that? I was very suspicious of her from the beginning, is kind of what she was saying. And so if you knew what you were looking for, you kind of knew what to be suspicious about. I kind of entered this reporting project trying to figure out, you know, what is it that Russia may have given the National Rifle Association over the last few years? What I realized was the real story was what the NRA had provided with Butina with, that she had been able to play all of these senior NRA officials and get them to work for her, get them to pay for her travel and expenses and conferences, and get them to hook her up with networking. And she was essentially in DC as someone who was trying to network and influence folks on behalf of the Russian government.
That was also interesting that came out that this was the Trump campaign actually proved itself quite resistant, thanks to Chris Cox, not least, about avoiding this kind of Russian interference. But why was the NRA so vulnerable? Why? I mean, and was it, do you think she tried the door locks on a number of different organizations and the NRA just seemed vulnerable to it? What was it about its culture that made it so susceptible to such a young operative?
Well, you know, I went into writing Misfire thinking that the NRA was this ruthlessly efficient, effective organization. And I came away after talking to dozens and dozens of people, over 120 interviews, thousands of pages of secret depositions, internal NRA emails and private documents. I came away with it realizing how chaotic and disorganized and ineffective it is inside, how it's ridden with conflict and factions and chaos. I mean, it is really a very colorful organization behind the scenes. They've got all sorts of leaders, different factions, all sorts of money moving around. And Maria Butina was able to take advantage of that and kind of charm one faction of the NRA to the point where she was able to get a lot of what she wanted in terms of networking and infiltrating the National Rifle Association's highest tiers of influence.
And at that point, too, this was when the IRA, sorry, the, it's funny how I keep wanting to call it the IRA. The NRA had a lot of money, especially to influence the 2016 elections. They came behind Trump early, so there was a lot of money. So they were really an intensely influential group at that time.
Absolutely. You know, the NRA gets quite successful during the Obama years, kind of trading off of this idea that President Obama wants to come after your guns or restrict your gun rights in some way. And that just really leads to, that's really leads over those years to very good fundraising and high membership numbers. And then, as you say, they were really instrumental in the election of Donald Trump. They spent more on the Trump campaign in 2016 than Trump's own super PAC did. An interesting fact is that after Access Hollywood and the release of those tapes, when everyone was fleeing from Donald Trump, the NRA actually doubles down and increases its ad buy in support of Donald Trump. But the irony is that though the election of Donald Trump is this incredible moment for the NRA and kind of the apex of its influence, that after Trump is elected, fundraising falls off a cliff and creates all these money struggles inside the organization that begin to reveal some of the corruption that happens there. I mean, in 2018, they were so struck by financial problems, they almost didn't make payroll, which, as you can imagine, is very serious problem for any organization.
Yeah, well, let's go back a little bit to its history, which, watching this organization throughout its history, what is it, about 80 years old, older?
150.
Okay. So watching it change over the years from primarily a sort of sportsman organization, nonpartisan, until what, almost yesterday, was definitely in favor of making sure that guns weren't used lawlessly, having protections against that. And then it was, I think, you write, around the time when it sort of went all in with Donald Trump, it moved away from that stand to becoming this group, to embracing the culture war. And that's how it's, and is that because once Donald Trump was elected, I mean, Obama was like the boogeyman. They could scare up donations, because obviously Obama was going to come and take your guns. But once Donald Trump was elected, they kind of killed the golden goose in that. And then, so they started to foment these kind of extreme culture wars to scare people into believing they still needed their guns. And that took on a different dimension.
I think there's always been this kind of tension between lobbyists in the NRA and then the people who work in messaging and fundraising, right? The lobbyists are looking for compromises, legislative compromises they can come to. The PR folks are interested in raising money and ginning up the base. And in this tension and in this factionalism that happens inside the NRA, ultimately the folks who work in PR and fundraising and membership end up winning out. And the NRA becomes a more kind of radically messaged organization. They start to move away from what had previously been a big strategic asset of theirs, which is, you know, the moderate Democrats that they could work with. They become much less focused after Sandy Hook with reaching out to Democrats and focus almost exclusively on reaching out to Republicans and conservatives for their base. It's been a pattern that continues now.
You point out that in these mass shootings, Columbine as well, the NRA took them as an opportunity to fundraise because, of course, in the wake of these massacres, they use, again, the scare tactic that these events will be used to take away your guns. But it also triggered real horror, including from Shannon Watts, who was then an at-home mother and decided that something had to be done. And began this grassroots organization of mothers. How effective have they been, do you think? And until that point, the gun control lobby hadn't been that effective, or it was kind of on the back burner. So maybe talk a little bit about the evolution post Sandy Hook of opposition now to the NRA, how effective it's been, and the importance really of women in this.
Yeah, I think Shannon Watts is a great example of a person who, along with the broader grassroots movement, was really mobilized by the events of Sandy Hook. And not only that, the failure of Manchin-Toomey, the legislation to expand background checks after Sandy Hook, which ultimately failed. That could have been the end of momentum for a lot of folks in on that side of the conversation. But instead, you know, Shannon Watts and folks on her side of that argument have really mobilized, grown, become more effective over the years. Before Sandy Hook, I think it's arguable that the gun safety or gun control movement was kind of listless, without a leader, without direction, without very much money. The NRA was kind of the only game in town, both in Washington, D.C. and at state capitals all across this country, where a lot of gun rules are made. But over the years after Sandy Hook, that and Manchin-Toomey transpire in the 2012-2013 timeframe. From that period, over the next few years, they build a pretty formidable grassroots organization that challenges the NRA. By 2018, the gun control movement actually outspends the NRA and the gun rights side for the first time. I mean, that's a remarkable thing that occurs over those few years, and really something that one of the unintended consequences of the failure of the Manchin-Toomey legislation.
Let's pause there so we can go to another message from one of our sponsors. If you have ever wanted to make your home feel safer, there's no better time than now. This week, our friends at Simply Safe are giving Femsplainers listeners early access to all their Black Friday deals, 50% off their award-winning home security. I love Simply Safe because it is so easy to install. You can do it yourself. There are no tools. And if I can do it, anyone can. And I love Simply Safe because it has everything I need to make our home safe. Indoor and outdoor cameras, comprehensive sensors, all monitored around the clock by trained professionals who send help the instant I need it. It was even named Best Home Security Systems of 2021 by U.S. News and World Report. Plus, you can easily customize a system for your home online in minutes and even get free custom recommendations from Simply Safe. These are Simply Safe's biggest discounts of the year. You can get a complete home security system starting at just over $100. There are no long-term contracts or commitments. It's a really easy way to start feeling a bit more peace of mind. Hurry, supplies are limited. Take 50% off at simplysafe.com/femsplainers. That's 50% off at SIMPLISAFE, simplysafe.com/femsplainers for your savings today. You wrote about the very male culture of the NRA executive. And boy, living in DC, I know this world. I've seen this world. It's the caucus room. It's cigars. It's steaks. It's groups of men drinking scotch, not a lot of room for women. You say it was one thing to be an elite executive like Wayne LaPierre's wife, Susan, who she started her own women's organizations within the organization. But the multiple women you write who work there reported a clubby male-dominated culture revolving around smoking cigars. The men in leadership were rarely invested in the professional growth of their female subordinates. While some male junior staffers were invited to cigar meetings with the boys, women were never allowed to join. Women were told to wear pantyhose and forbidden from showing their shoulders. You had to fight for every advancement. If you were a sensitive female who didn't like sex jokes and cussing, you wouldn't enjoy working there. Yikes.
Yeah, I mean, there's an incredible story being told by some of these women who worked at the NRA and really struggled to find just kind of basic respect and to equal footing with their male peers. I mean, the fact is the NRA was an incredibly difficult place for a lot of women to work for a long period of time.
Well, and that's what makes me wonder if it would have been, if a female executive would have been so vulnerable to a Maria Butina, or whether she would have seen through that immediately. But it's almost like Maria got passed around and then pushed out when they needed to charm a big donor. But it was, again, in this context of this male world. There were no women, not even Susan LaPierre, weighing in on the influence of this person.
Yeah, I mean, and actually, Susan LaPierre immediately took a disliking to Maria Butina and avoided her very conscientiously throughout the time that Maria Butina was trying to network with senior officials in the NRA.
Let's talk about Susan LaPierre for a bit, because you describe Wayne LaPierre, contrary to the PR he generates or the NRA generates about him, as this kind of bureaucratic worm who can't make decisions and gets captive by, his lawyers, and is always like self-pitying. Like one of his chief reactions you wrote about after a mass shooting was, oh, poor me, this is really going to be look bad on me, and now I'm going to get more threats. But he was never, and maybe he never seemed to be charmed by Maria, that he, sex was not his thing, and he wasn't really into fancy lifestyles, fancy suits. And that changed when he met Susan. So let's tell me about Susan and how her influence over the NRA.
The book starts out with this scene at Wayne LaPierre's wedding. And he doesn't show up, does not That's right. want to get married to Susan LaPierre, does not want to do it. So the ceremony, it was supposed to start, he's not there. And his best man who's with him says, you know, I don't think you should marry him either. And puts a $100 bill on the dashboard of the car and says, we can drive out of here if you want. But he ultimately goes in to talk with Susan and is kind of harangued and berated until to the point where he agrees to go through with the ceremony. And it's just this awkward kind of weird event.
She's been left standing at the altar, basically. The church is filled with important Washingtonians.
Right. Important Washingtonians. Even Oliver North is there, and he becomes important later.
Yeah.
But, you know, he eventually does show up, and the ceremony starts, you know, very late. And it's just this weird event where he can't make eye contact with his bride. And he's looking up, he's looking down at the floor, he's looking around, but he just refuses to make eye contact. And there's a point to telling the story. The point is that a lot of people around Wayne LaPierre and powerful figures in the NRA realized over time that all you had to do with Wayne is put enough pressure on him, and eventually he would give you what you wanted, whether that's millions of dollars for big vendors who are getting great deals from the NRA to do not nearly as much work as the money would suggest. A lot of people where senior executives or former officials got these really extravagant golden parachutes as a result of being able to pressure Wayne LaPierre. And yeah, Susan,
like a million plus a year for years, even after they had ceased working for the NRA.
Like those millions. Are great deals.
I'd like one.
and Susan LaPierre is no exception. She finds that she's able to get what she wants from Wayne LaPierre if she hassles him enough. And this
true
this
of most. By the way, just that's we can't just put this one on Susan. This wives throughout time have known this.
But you know, obviously, he's uniquely susceptible to his wife. But he's broadly susceptible to this issue and uniquely susceptible to his wife in this case. But for all of Wayne's, all the descriptions of those who've known the two of these people best over the years, while Wayne is weak-willed and almost cowardly, Susan LaPierre has extravagant tastes and is very bold and is very assertive and gets what she wants. You know, you talk to people who knew Wayne LaPierre in the 80s, and they describe him as like Mr. Rumpled Suit, you know, like didn't care about what he was wearing or what he looked like and how he dressed at all. But after he marries Susan LaPierre, you're talking millions of dollars in private jets. You're talking exotic vacations to the Bahamas and Lake Como in Italy. You're talking about extravagant meals. You're talking about
his suits. He ups his suit game.
Six figures in Italian menswear from
all paid for the donors, all paid for the card-carrying members of the NRA. Which, lest we forget, it's not coming from multi-millionaires and billionaires. These are very middle-class grassroots who provide the budget of the NRA.
Yeah, I think one of the big reasons why. You know, I had over 120 interviews with insiders and people inside the NRA orbit, is that a lot of people were enraged with Wayne LaPierre. Mm-hmm. They felt that his actions and those of senior officials had been a betrayal to blue collar workers who were setting aside 10, 15, 20 bucks a month towards an organization they thought was acting in their interests and pushing things they believed in. But it turns out so much of this was going towards vacations and meals and trips for Wayne LaPierre to get on a yacht or things like that.
And he kept saying, and he had a culture around him, so nobody would question it. And then Susan co-founded something called the NRA's Leadership Forum, which was supposed to promote networking amongst women who love guns, I guess. But it actually became something of a mean girls club. Like what happened with that?
This is something called the Women's Leadership Forum.
Yeah.
And they had kind of tiers. They had different kinds of brooches depending on how much money you had donated to the National Rifle Association. It became a very kind of competitive place. Who's in, who's out, who's sitting at Susan LaPierre's table, who's sitting close to Susan LaPierre. And, you know, in decades past, the NRA had been kind of a very modest place that not really focused on extravagance in terms of food or dress, where those kinds of tastes were kind of frowned upon as a little bit too much. But Susan LaPierre is part of this change in the evolution of the NRA towards one in which fashion and high tastes are considered the standard.
Yeah, I've never understood the brooch fetish in Washington circles, you know, that a lot of organizations use these for women that get little eagle pins and things. And I've never really appealed to me, but yes. Okay. So she does this. And meanwhile, I think what bothers me about it, and Shannon and I talked a little bit about this, that you can be pro-gun as a woman without succumbing to the NRA's messaging, one of which was, as you point out, during they ran a lot of campaigns against Hillary Clinton during the election. And basically, a lot of that focus was scaring women that they would no longer have guns to defend themselves if Hillary got elected.
That's right. It was an interesting approach when it comes to the NRA's views of women. It really was trying to reach out to a certain demographic that felt that they would not be able to defend themselves, that their Second Amendment rights would be under attack if Hillary Clinton were to be elected. The NRA really viewed Hillary Clinton's election as kind of a do or die moment. Because if you'll recall, Scalia had passed away.
Right.
And they felt that if Hillary Clinton were allowed to nominate his successor, that could really threaten some of the constitutional cases regarding the Second Amendment that had come by over the past decade.
Well, I thought their views about women were also epitomized by, how do I pronounce her name? Dana Lash. Oh my! I saw one clip of her when I guess they were doing NRA TV. And I couldn't believe this person, that she was sort of screaming at the camera, and it was, yeah, it was like watching some, I don't know, right-wing version of QAnon trying to just scare everybody into what was going on. And then she left. Like, what happened with her, and who was she anyway?
So Dana Lash was a spokesperson for the NRA, and she also was a host of a very controversial show on NRA TV. You know, one thing I say in the book is that the NRA is an organization with a Fox and Friends leadership, but a Field and Stream membership.
Right.
Did I say that right?
Yeah. No, you didn't say it on the, but that was a great line. Yeah. It made total sense. Yeah.
But what happens actually is that the NRA's members that donate money and are most activated are also the ones that respond well to more ideological and polarizing messaging. And that's part of what happens with Dana Lash, who is a very fiery commentator.
Does this message really resonate with women and, you know, suburban mothers, the people that politicians have to court? That NRA does really make it either or. You either support us and everything we stand for, or, you know, it's the end of the Second Amendment. Do you feel that message is still effective, or is it waning?
I don't know. I think the NRA right now is struggling to find a message at all for, put aside women, but, yeah, you know, Americans in general. I mean, you look at the situation that they're in. They've got members revolting. They've got more board of directors. Some of their directors are protesting, serious financial issues. They've got a New York Attorney General investigation and litigation that seeks to shut the entire National Rifle Association down and very well could dissolve the organization in the coming year or so. I mean, they've got serious, serious problems, and they struggled to find messaging to deal with all of the above.
But what was sort of discouraging about your book is the, you know, you could just, as you did, you go on for chapters about the corruption. And again, all at the highest level, that the staff, the employees of the NRA were very, I mean, there were times they wouldn't even be able to get coffee in the office because the budget was so cut. But meanwhile, yeah, Wayne LaPierre is on his private jet. Suzanne is booking their vacations on the dime of the NRA. But even despite this, and despite Ollie North comes out as a bit of a, you know, a bit of a hero in the telling, like they make him president, hoping he'll just sort of fall in line. But he ends up trying to get to the bottom of the spending and the accounting and the corruption. But in the end, they manage to get rid of him. They get rid of Chris Cusk. They get rid of every single person, it seems, who questioned or was going to be able to shed light on what was going on. And Wayne LaPierre remains there. The other people around him who enable him remain there. You know, they've been investigated for several years. They do seem invincible. They do seem like some Medusa head where you cut one head off and another snake pops up.
Yeah, I think any sober analysis would take note of just how many times the NRA has been counted out and how many times they've continued to live on, that the organization itself and Wayne LaPierre in particular has been very resilient. This is hardly the first time that he's faced controversy. It just happens to be that this is the most serious threat to his existence as the leader of the organization and the NRA in general. I want to kind of return to the Oliver North story, because there's a really climactic scene in the book in which Oliver North and Wayne LaPierre confront one another in an Indianapolis hotel suite. And, you know, Oliver North is trying to seek this internal audit of the NRA to figure out where the money's going. But Wayne LaPierre and other top officials in the organization refuse to let him and push him out as president. That's one of the many kind of scenes that are right. shown in Misfire.
Right. No, it was, you know, all the shows that get made about Washington, and they're always like over the top, or things don't really happen the way they seem to, and there are spies, and this really is like some crazy, you know, Washington, exactly as you would expect it in TV, with these sort of fat cat bosses, the fetching Russian spy, the people backstabbing each other, the hobnobbing with presidents, you know. It was very dramatic. And also, I'm sorry, I just found it very depressing. But you think there is a possibility. Do you see at the NRA ever returning to its roots? Do you see it ever suggesting responsible policies that as it used to, for like not opposing background checks, for example? Do you ever see it had that returning?
Well, right now, I mean, I think its most urgent threat is just surviving as an organization at all. I mean, the New York Attorney General has accused them of more than $60 million of misallocation of members' funds. And you know, finances inside the organization. So the big question is whether or not a judge will agree with the New York Attorney General and actually order the dissolution of the NRA. That's going to take place. That decision is going to take place sometime, you'd imagine, in the next year or so. And whether they can survive that legal challenge is really going to be determinative of what happens in gun politics in this country.
Yeah. As you point out with Bettina, her downfall came that she was riding high for a while. She was sending, we used to call cables back to her friends in the Russian government, boasting about her success and conquests, about penetrating this club, getting to the highest levels of conservative politics. And then what happened to Marie? How did the fall come?
Well, so she was ultimately charged with being an unregistered agent of the Russian government, and she was convicted of it. So she went to prison and then was ultimately deported.
But who squealed on her, as it were? Like, who in the end, like, how did she finally,
you know, the law enforcement never described who it was that gave the tip or tips that led them to their conclusion. They put out plenty of evidence about why they felt that that Maria Butina was an unregistered Russian agent, but they never said who tipped them off.
Right, but didn't you break a story right when she was celebrating the Donald Trump win that put fear into her?
Yeah, I mean, I was doing reporting about her in 2017 in real time before she was arrested, kind of saying, you know, this is a very strange situation in which a Russian citizen is really getting in tight with the NRA. And I have it on good authority that that was something that interested law enforcement.
Well, did you ever get approached by the FBI?
No.
No. Tim, how did you get some of these secret documents? Like, is that like happen in a movie or a spy drop? Like, how does you and an investigative reporter get this information?
So one of the big breakthroughs that happened with this book, I mean, this was written during the pandemic mostly. And one of the big breakthroughs happened in March or April of 2020, when things were really at their worst, everything was shut down. But a source had indicated to me that the source would be willing to provide some of these documents, hundreds of pages of, you know, never before seen documents that were really critical to some of my work. And so I ended up because there was no public transit, no cabs. I ended up renting a moped and driving for what seemed like hours and hours and hours, and met a source in a parking lot. And the source pulls up and rolls the passenger window down and says, the documents are in the passenger seat. And I reach in, grab the documents, put it in my backpack, and then moped away.
Wow, that's like, that is like a scene, like more like a 1950s Italian movie with the moped thing. And these documents were from what? These were like internal memos, congressionally?
These were very important documents that are, you know, kind of critical to my being able to describe a lot of things that happened in the book.
And but like memos or hearing, like, give me a sense of what they were.
They were really important documents.
Who is your source, Tim? Come on. Did he have a mask on? Or I guess if it was a pandemic, he was, you couldn't even see his or her face.
I don't think we even interacted, like, other than, you know.
Wow.
The document ran off.
All right, Tim. Well, thank you. Thank you for being a mansplainer and the femsplainers, a gunsplainer. And good luck with everything. We'll make sure you get fed during your long and, I hope, very successful tour.
Thank you so much.
All right, take care. Well, thank you, everyone, for listening. I hope y'all enjoyed that. Go secure your guns. And again, Tim's book is Misfire: Inside the Downfall of the NRA. And we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening. The Femsplainers is a weekly podcast carried on the Podcast One Network. Nat Frum produces and edits our audio and video. You can follow us on Twitter and FB at Femsplainers and on Instagram at Femsplainers Podcast. We love hearing from you. You can reach out to us via email at contact@femsplainers.com. You'll find all our episodes and more information about me and the podcast at femsplainers.com. And remember, we rely on your donations to keep this podcast going. So please consider supporting us at patreon.com/femsplainers.